Hello and welcome to Sovereign Massive Podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin, and this week we are talking Basque elections. Last night, EH Bildu made historic gains for the pro-independence Basque nationalist left. I think they won 100,000 extra votes in terms of seats through level with the centre-right Basque Nationalist Party. They were historic gains, but it does look like the same governing coalition of the centre-right Basque Nationalist Party, the Socialist Party, will continue government with a majority. I'm joined to discuss this in a bit more detail by journalist Ben Ray. He's a Scottish journalist based in the Basque country. He published a very interesting piece on the day of the elections on Sunday in Jacobin, discussing the campaign, discussing what is behind Bildu's pretty historic gains in the last few years. Hey Ben, how's it going?
Hi Owen, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, great to be joined by you. I guess that's the thing. There is in a sense sort of a historic nature to these elections, but at the same time something slightly maybe unsatisfactory. EH Bildu didn't quite reach a sort of paso, and we are sort of continuing with the same governing coalition, it looks like in the Basque country. So what are your main takeaways from yesterday's results?
Yeah, my feeling is a slight deflation, to be honest, because in advance of the election, I mean, the result of it was within the margin of error of the polls, right, which always had it very close between EH Bildu and the Basque Nationalist Party, Penelope. But Bildu was slightly ahead in the polls. And it looked like when the first results came in at 9 p.m. last night, Bildu had one more seat than in the Basque Nationalist Party. And then it was kind of to-ing and fro-ing for the next like hour and a half. It was like sort of on a knife edge. In the end, they both ended up on 27. And then ECA, the Basque branch of PSOE, we ended up on 12. And 27 plus 12 for the Basque Nationalist Party and PSOE is 39, and you need 38 for an absolute majority. So that's what's going to happen. They're going to repeat that coalition government, which is kind of like seen as like the sort of the establishment now in sort of Basque politics. PSOE supports a Basque nationalist government. So in that sense, there's a little bit of a feeling of deflation about the result. But you look at it in a broader context, EH Bildu, I think it was, started existing in 2011, so that's 13 years. He's only existed for 13 years. Before that, the kind of part of the forerunner, not the whole of the forerunner, but part of the forerunner to EH Bildu was Eri Batasuna, which was made illegal in 2001. So you think about it in that context, they've gone from, you know, being illegal to establishing themselves in 2011 to now being level on seats with the Basque Nationalist Party. It's a very rapid advance in just 13 years. So in that sense, it is a big change. And they've won, the EH Bildu won six more seats in the last election, 2020. The Basque Nationalist Party went down four. So things are for a while now, for the last few elections, have been trending in the direction of EH Bildu. But they didn't quite manage to get beyond the Basque Nationalist Party, which still has the most votes and is even with seats. So it's kind of seen as if the Basque Nationalist Party just won the election because they've won out in terms of votes. Because the way it's organised is the three provinces, Biscaya, Guipúzcoa, and Araba, they all have 25 seats, the three provinces, mm-hmm. the Basque Autonomous Community, regardless of the population. And in Vizcaya, where Bilbao is by far the biggest population, and that's where the Basque Nationalist Party is strongest. So even though, you know, they didn't win more seats than Bildu, they've got, I think it's something like 3% higher vote than Bildu. So they're seen as, they are the winners of the election, even though they've lost quite a lot of seats. And Bildu have just missed out on kind of becoming the first force. Even if they had become the first force, it's likely that PSOE and the Basque Nationalist Party would have continued to govern. They would have found a way to do it. But nonetheless, that kind of element which would have made it a big story in the whole of Europe, is slightly missing from it. So for my feelings, slightly one of deflation.
I mean, it is a pretty incredible and rapid rise, as you said, like such a short period. And also, it seems, in one sense, a more sustained growth. It hasn't been sort of what we saw, I think, with Podemos in the Basque Country was that it did, it won obviously the national elections in 2015, and did quite well in the regional elections, and hasn't been able to sustain it. It does seem to be sort of on the ground. Obviously, it's a what's the word, like a Basque-based party, so there isn't much more of a ground organization. I mean, obviously, when you look at Basque elections from Madrid, you get a very it's very hard to sort of penetrate in some ways via the national media, in terms of obviously the particularly in the last week of the campaign, the Spanish Madrid-based media sort of manufactured this slight hysteria around, ETA, around the fact that Bildu's candidate wouldn't recognize ETA as a terrorist organization. I mean, I think he seemed he later said he was very tired in the interview of Cadena Ser, but it was a very clumsy answer in the sense. I get the sense what like Sinn Féin politicians are very skilled in terms of just avoiding those type of traps. Obviously, that was sort of the focus. It didn't seem to have much of an impact in terms of the end results, it would seem, but it was certainly the focus in the last week of the campaign in the national Madrid-based media. Beyond that, what are the factors that have led to Bildu's rise? Expansion of its vote. Where is this vote coming from? Are they eating both into the socialist vote and the old Unidos Podemos vote? Where is the vote coming from, and what are the factors that are driving their rise?
I mean, I think one way of thinking about H.E. Bildu is, which makes it a bit more simple for people maybe not from Spain to understand, is it is quite similar to Sinn Féin in Ireland in terms of its history, its links to the armed conflict. Sinn Féin's links to the IRA, H.E. Bildu's links to ETA. And the end of the armed struggle in Ireland has seen Sinn Féin's vote grow steadily until it's now the first force. And a similar dynamic, I think, is taking root in the Basque Country, whereby, I mean, there's always been a strong what do they call it, Abertzale left tradition, which means like Solventist left tradition in the Basque Country. It wasn't reflected politically in elections because of the situation with ETA and the armed conflict that was going on for years until it ended in 2011 officially. It started to tail off in the decade before that. And so that political tradition's always been very strong. It's always been very organized, well-rooted. And the end of it has allowed it to have more of an effect electorally, and to appeal to a wider audience. Whereas before that, those that are closely, those who closely attach themselves to the Basque identity, and if people don't know, the Basque language is, completely different from Spanish. Basque identity is a very strong thing and very important part of Basque society. They didn't really have anywhere else to go except the Basque Nationalist Party, right, which has been the dominant party since the end of the dictatorship. It's been out of 40 out of 44 years of post-dictatorship year, it's been in power. So it's one of the most successful political parties in Europe in that time. And that party is like the establishment, really, in the Basque Country. It sort of represents like the Basque capitalist class, and is always been extremely strong. Partly because of the weakness, the electoral weakness of the Abertzale left, is that which has allowed it to dominate for so long. So it's very very clear that the end of the armed conflict is the key to H.E. Bildu's rise. there's a lot of factors, more kind of short-term factors at play as well. This isn't short-term, this is actually very long-term, but it's a different factor, which is the sort of neoliberal agenda which the Basque Nationalist Party has pursued has kind of created a crisis within public services in the Basque Country, which was the key to the election campaign. The health service the Basque Country spends the least of any autonomous community in terms of their capita on its health service. A lot of people use the private health service here, and the waiting lists in the public health service are out of control. A third of workers in the working hospitals are on temporary or interim contracts. So it's kind of the health service here in the Basque Country has become representative of, or sort of symbolic of, a sort of running down of public services, of privatisation that the Basque Nationalist Party has really been responsible for. Because, I mean, obviously, Basque Country is within Spain, but there is fiscal autonomy here, you know, so there's quite a lot of room within the Basque Country, one of the wealthier parts of one of the wealthier regions of Spain. There's plenty of money in the Basque Country to fund decent public services, but the Basque Nationalist Party has not been doing that. So that's part of the story as well, is people being fed up with the rule of the Basque Nationalist Party. And I guess the third factor I would include is the decline of the what people call in the confederal left, you know, the left that's not pro-independence, and that's, you know, the parties are centred on Madrid, and that's Podemos, the decline of Podemos, and obviously the fact that Podemos and Sumar have had this split, and both parties have stood separately in this election. As you've mentioned, in the general election in 2015, I think in 2016 was there also a general
election? As well, yeah, and it was two elections within 6 months. Exactly.
Two elections, Podemos had the most votes in the Basque Country. It's quite remarkable. So since then, with the split, they've lost that strength that they've had. And a lot of that has gone to Eche Bildu. So Eche Bildu's winning votes away from, on the right, away from the Basque Nationalist Party, and it's winning votes from the left, from Podemos. So that's really the two sources of their strength. I think another thing is about young people, you know, because there's a big generational divide in Basque politics. Young people tend to be less affected by the history of the armed conflict, and they very much are pro-Eche Bildu. Older people tend to vote for the Basque Nationalist Party. So there's a big generational divide, like we see in many, many parts of the world, but in the Basque Country, it's divided between the two nationalist forces primarily. I mean, the Basque Parliament now is more nationalist than it's ever been since, you know, the first post-Franco election in 1980, and it's also more left than it's been than previously, because of the decline of the Basque Nationalist Party. So, you know, definitely it's for Eche Bildu, it's moving in the right direction. But they don't have any partners to govern with, you know, because Pessoa's committed to governing with the Basque Nationalist Party. The last thing they wanted to do is to govern with Bildu, because the effect that would have on Spanish politics. And the problem with the decline of the confederal left in the Basque Country means there's no obvious partner for Bildu to govern. So that's going to be a continual problem for them, even if they had won the elections, either do in the next one. Do they have a partner to actually govern with? It's not clear that they do.
One of the headlines here in Madrid has been PSOE, the socialists, seem pretty happy with their results, even though historically it's on the lower end of what they would have got. I mean, compared to 4 years ago, it's slightly up. But as you said, Pachi Lopez did rule late 2000s, I think it was, wasn't it? Like sort of
2009 to 2012.
Just around the financial crisis. But since then, they've obviously dropped support. I mean, I imagine there's an element of one element in the generational divide, I imagine, is there as well. Maybe older progressive. I mean, obviously, you have these two axes and key axes in Basque politics. One is the question of nationalism or sovereignty, and the other is a left right divide. And I imagine there is a certain number of votes. Maybe, I mean, it's always very hard to say, but like, you know, areas where maybe the socialists did well 20 years ago, the younger generation is now going by Bildu as well. So I mean, I imagine the socialist heartland was sort of like, was it like the sort of metropolitan area of Bilbao, the industrial towns, etc. And I don't know if they are still winning in those type of areas anymore. Or, you know, or are the younger people just, you know, as you said, they don't have an issue with the sort of sovereigntist left?
I think this, the Socialist Party are, you know, kind of celebrating the election as like they're the ones that kind of won the election, which is a bit rich. The vote only went up 0.5%.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
They did get them two additional seats. So I think that's the thing. They're pretty happy about. But, you know, since that, what you talked about, 2009, when they entered government, they got 30% that election. And now they're down at 14%. So they're still, you know, they're definitely the third force in Basque politics, but they're a long way behind the two nationalist parties. And I think the Spanish politics comes so much into it with PC. Like I think that's really the key to understanding why they take the decisions they take. I mean, no one's even talking about it, but you could have after this election. PC and Bildu government in the Basque Autonomous Community. The votes are there to do that. It's the first time that the votes have been, the seats, sorry, it's the first time the seats have been there to have such a coalition. But it's not been talked about because they're so clear that they're in no way that they're going to govern with Bildu. And the only reason that makes any sense is because they're terrified of that association with ETA and the attacks of the right-wing media that you touched upon, which I don't think has much effect on Basque politics these days.
No.
You know, I don't think there's many people in the Basque country who listen to that and take it seriously. You know, listen to people like Ayuso and take what she says seriously. But ETA, the ghost of ETA, it does actually is quite important to the narratives of Spanish politics. You know, because it's that fear of, you know, if we let these people into power, you know, they're going to run amok. You know, I think that's a big part of the kind of psyche of the right wing in Spain.
Yeah.
The kind of the I think Ayuso says, it is still alive, it's still in power. You know,
it's it, yeah.
They want to generate fear about ETA. You know, and the more distance there is to the end of ETA, the more it's ramped up, you know, because it's completely out of touch with reality. But I do think it's quite important to the dynamics of Spanish politics. But Basque politics is a different thing. And I don't think there's many voters here who really decide how to vote based on, you know, what terminology you use to describe ETA, because they've lived through it, you know. So it's a bit more real than that, you know.
Well, I thought it was interesting, even the fact that, I mean, as you said, ETA was a key smear against Sanchez in the general election last year. But I think what was most interesting about the Basque elections was the PP didn't talk about ETA. It was the socialists and it was the progressive media in Madrid who were talking about ETA this time. The whole thing was being generated basically by the socialists as a means, I imagine, to try and give the Basque nationalists a bit of a boost and to change the dynamic a little bit. I mean, the other element, I guess, of national politics at play here is the fact that I saw a tweet from the socialist head of communication saying, you know, 85% of Basques voted for parties that were in favor of the current government. Because when we're talking about these sort of different levels of governance, Both Bildu and the Basque Nationalist Party are in Madrid, at least two of the smaller allies, you know, sort of, you know, two of the smaller satellites basically around Sanchez. Because if this election wasn't brilliant by historic standards for the socialists, and it wasn't, it shows further decline in the the sort of periphery of the Spanish state for the socialists. On the other hand, it reinforces Sanchez as the only sort of national figure able to, you know, able to bring together a political majority in Spain, the Spanish state. And it's a political majority which he is very much at the center. And he's able to play off these various nationalists and left-wing forces against each other. You know, he's now able to balance Basque nationalists and Junts off against Sumar, reducing their weight, etc. And it is an interesting, I guess, element in that sense. Because, yeah, I mean, and on the other hand, the reason why the Spanish nationalist right cannot get into government at a national level is the fact that they can, you know, you cannot be sort of marginal forces in Catalonia, the Basque country, governed in Madrid. It just doesn't work. Spain is not Castilla. And so it has reinforced Sanchez's centrality in the Madrid national politics.
I mean, it's worth remembering that after the July general election last year, the PP made an approach to the Basque Nationalist Party to see if they can get their support. But it would have required the Basque Nationalist Party to have backed a PP and Vox government. And that would be like writing a suicide note in the Basque country, because, you know, Vox is just a no-go area. So the Basque Nationalist Party historically has been quite happy to back PP government. But because of the polarization in Spanish politics now, is not able to do that. And you're right that, you know, the two great rivals of Basque politics are the Basque Nationalist Party and Etxe Bildu, but they're both supporting the same Sanchez coalition government in Madrid. And actually, both of those parties, I think, especially, this is especially a long-term problem for Etxe Bildu, I don't think they have any idea of how to go beyond being a sort of player within Spanish politics that can, you know, push for some reforms here and there if they have some leverage, but little more than that, you know, in terms of an agenda to achieve their aims, which is independence. I wouldn't say the Basque Nationalist Party, even though it's called the Basque Nationalist Party, it doesn't really believe in independence in any, you know, it wouldn't ever try to do anything to make it happen. So although it kind of plays on that identity, it's not seriously a pro-independence party, the Basque Nationalist Party. It's more, you know, once a pro-autonomy party, once the Statute of Guernica, which was the kind of statute which established the Basque Autonomous Community, it wants all of those powers delivered, because they haven't, even now, over 40 years on, they still haven't all been delivered to the Basque Autonomous Community. And it probably wants some other devolved powers if it could get them. And the Etxe Bildu is a pro-independence party, but it doesn't. I think the same for Junts per Catalunya and the same for Esquerra Republicana in Catalunya. They don't have any clear agenda for how to achieve that, I think, at the moment. The arms struggle is clearly gone. They now explicitly reject that as a way to achieve independence. The wildcat independence referendum route is clearly gone. The amnesty laws sort of drawn a line under that, or might have drawn a line under it. But in terms of an actual plan for how to get there, the only thing you hear people talking about is to reform the constitution, which would require a two-thirds majority. And, you know, it's just not the, as you say, impossible. It's impossible to imagine the numbers in the Spanish Congress for such a reform. So there's a little bit of an impasse, I think, for all of the independence forces in you know, the Basque Country and in Catalonia. But at the moment, I think Bildu's first aim is to try and get into power in the Basque Autonomous Community. That's his kind of first objective, to try to become like a sort of hegemonic force at that level. And it uses it's kind of has gained credibility for the fact that it's, you know, the Spanish government relies on its votes to govern. It's even won some reforms, not in this parliamentary term, but in the last one, it negotiated some reforms. So it's kind of a strange thing, you know. These parties have such different identities, and they're rhetorically in conflict with each other quite a lot. But in terms of their political practice, There isn't actually that much difference between what how Bildu operates at Spanish level and how Sumar operates and how Pessoa operates. You know what I mean? They're all trying to, just one degree or another, kind of achieve reforms for the Spanish state.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at a political level, the difference maybe between the type of subordinate position that Sumar finds itself in and within the sort of Madrid politics and maybe Bildu does is one thing that I think it was Dan Finn who said about Sinn Féin and the Scottish Nationalist Party is they do have having the sort of sovereigntist agenda does give you the advantage of sort of having one foot in and one foot out. You can play the reformist game in the institutions while at the same time maintaining a sort of horizon in the more medium and long term, you know, as a clear part of your identity. The Spanish left have had that much, you know, it just doesn't have that same, you know, you just tend to be sucked into the institutions on a sort of any type of transformative horizon, whether on the constitutional level or otherwise, just sort of disappears. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sort of internal dynamics within Bildu. Obviously, there, you say in your piece, it was sort of formed out of two parties. What are the different forces? Because when people sort of just shout at Bildu, you know, it's a very reductive term. I mean, you know, even the, you know, when we talk about the end of the armed struggle in the Basque Country, it was a process. It was also, maybe people in Madrid would like to say, you know, Spanish democracy defeated ETA, whereas it was much more, you know, complex dynamic in which a lot of people within the movement long before were trying to put an end to the armed struggle, trying to, you know, it's sought as sort of self-defeating. The interesting, I guess, contrast again is with Sinn Féin, the IRA in Northern Ireland, where they were able to push through the sort of chain, that sort of ending of the armed struggle a lot quicker. Oh, like, I mean, I guess the sort of core leadership in Sinn Féin from the early 80s onwards with the hunger strikes realized that there was a real opening for sort of political engagement, electoral engagement.
Yeah, I mean, ETA was established in 1958, right, when Franco was in total control, and it was seen as it was actually a break from the Basque Nationalist Party, a kind of youth split from the Basque Nationalist Party, because it was seen as that the Basque Nationalist Party leadership, which was in exile, was not doing anything basically to resist Franco's dictatorship. So obviously, I mean, I'm not going to go through all what ETA did, but by the time of the transition, they had a decision to make, right? Were they going to, you know, become like a sort of democratic party, or were they going to continue the armed struggle? And their basic analysis was that the Spanish state hasn't changed; it's basically the same as it was, but a few tweaks, and therefore we continue the armed struggle. And I mean, it was very obvious that was a major error, and they began to lose a lot of support within Basque society fairly quickly after the transition. So yeah, it's quite clear that the armed struggle should have been ended a lot sooner than it was. And by the time it did in 2011, as you said, there had been talks before them about ending it, which the key person in those talks was Arnaldo Otegi, who's the general secretary of the Eche Bildu now. He was actually imprisoned from 2009 to 2016. It's called the Bitaguna case, I think. And alongside four other people from the sort of Albert's early life tradition, for speaking to ETA, but they've always said what we were speaking to ETA about was the resolution, you know, was bringing the armed conflict to an end. It's basically generally accepted now that Otegi played an important role in negotiating the end of ETA. So that same year that ETA laid down arms, 2011, officially disbanded in 2018, but 2011, it's called AETA, it's a kind of key date. That's when Euskadi Libre, which basically means Basque Country Unite, that's when that was formed as a coalition between Sortu, which is a sort of party of the Albert Sally left tradition, but the first one in its formation to have explicitly rejected the use of political violence as a strategy to achieve your aims, and Usko Alkartasuna, which means like sort of Basque alternative. And that is like a sort of social democratic split from the Basque Nationalist Party in the 1980s. And one of its members is a former leader of what they call Lehendakai, which is like the first minister of the Basque Autonomous Community. He was a Lehendakai in the 1980s. But the Óscar Arkadatsuna is this kind of smaller force within Eyjafjallajökull. Sóttu is really the dominant force. In fact, a lot of members of Óscar Arkadatsuna are not very happy with their participation in it because they feel like they've kind of been marginalized. The Eyjafjallajökull has kind of become, it's still a coalition, but it's become a party in its own right, you know. And it's been quite clear. They've been quite, over the years, they've become increasingly comfortable with disassociating themselves from the sort of armed struggle from ETA. In 2021, on the 10th anniversary of AETA, they made a kind of historic statement where they said that the ETA should have never happened, basically, and they kind of, tried to draw a line under it entirely. The Spanish media won't let them draw a line under it. They always tried to find a new way to bring it up. In local elections last year, there was a kind of manufactured scandal over seven ex-ETA members standing in the local elections. Now, I think there's 4,500 candidates, because there's lots of municipalities have candidates everywhere. So it was a tiny proportion who were ex-ETA members. They had ex-ETA members standing in every single election since Eyjafjallajökull existed, but they started the scandal over it. And actually, Eyjafjallajökull said, look, we know why you're doing this, but we're gonna accept it anyway, and they withdrew the seven candidates. So they have been, I think, to the frustration of some people inside the coalition, very accommodating to these kind of demands to disassociate themselves and that sort of thing. But they'll never end these demands, because they serve a political purpose. But I think what my sense of Óscar Arkadatsuna living here is that they're extremely strongly rooted in the towns of the Basque Country. I live in a town, they're very strongly rooted in this town. And that's the real base of their power. It's not the cities. In that sense, it's very different from where I'm from, Scotland, where the cities are the more center of the independence of the Scottish National Party. Here it's more the towns. It's because the towns, the Basque language tends to be stronger. The Basque traditions tend to be stronger. They're less cosmopolitan, and in that. So the role of culture in the nationalist politics here is much greater than it is in Scotland, where it's really about the sort of economic issues, Whereas economic issues matter here, but the roots of the movement is really rooted in the fact that Basque Country is quite a distinct place, culturally and in terms of the language and all that sort of thing. So it's a very strong party in that sense. It seems to have it. You never really see them fighting in public. They're very disciplined, and they do have like debates, internal debates and all that, but they usually stay internal.
Internal.
So I think it's probably the same with Sinn Féin, isn't it? Like
It is.
because of the roots of these parties, they have a certain like tradition of discipline and organization, which maybe the more modern left organizations don't have,
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that leads us on maybe to the other story, which is the division on the Spanish or the Confederate left in the Basque Country between Podemos and Sumar. I mean, I'm not even sure where to start. It's pretty depressing stuff. Sort of amused that maybe the one MP that Sumar got is the Secretary General of the Communist Party, who are being slightly sidelined at the moment in the construction of Sumar. People in Esquerda Unida, the communist back left here in Madrid, have sort of been telling me that they really feel they've lost weight within the coalition or within the platform since Podemos have left. There is definitely an imbalance. More, it's the sort of green element of this sort of broad front, progressive left coalition has definitely gained a lot more weight, and you can see it in their messaging and in the candidates, they're putting forward. I mean, I don't know what your take is in the. I mean, obviously, like the Sumar candidate was sort of I'd say very little known. I think she was a runner-up in the Podemos primaries, the last Podemos primaries. She was a technical advisor in the previous parliament. Not someone with any public profile. Podemos seem to be going for these type of more professional, technical candidates who just, particularly when you're fighting a defensive campaign, maybe aren't the best type of profile to go for. But I'm not sure how you've seen this division and how it's played out in the Basque Country.
It's been frustrating to watch this election campaign, because the debate that took place earlier this week had the sort of leading candidates from each party, and I was quite impressed with both the Sumar candidate and the Podemos candidate. I think actually they were more impressive to me than the Bildu candidate. They're talking about a lot about the housing crisis and that sort of thing. You couldn't identify any political differences between them, and I think that's a lot of people from the outside looking in on the Sumar Podemos divide find it absolutely bewildering, because it's hard to identify what the differences are. If you combine their votes, so I think it was 2.4% for Podemos and 3.3% for Samoa. There's an analysis published in the Basque newspaper Gara today that if you combine their votes together, Samoa won one seat, Podemos won none. But if they had stood together, you combine the votes together, they would have won three seats, and they would have taken one off the Basque Nationalist Party and one off BCE, which would have denied those parties a majority in the Basque Parliament. And, if they'd stood together, their vote would actually have probably been better than that, because people, I think I've spoken to people who've said, well, I'm not going to vote for them when they're all over the place divided like this, you know. So it could have been a really historic election, this one, if those parties had stood together. There was negotiations until, I think, about 1 month or 6 weeks before the election to try to get them to stand together. It didn't happen. You know more than I will about the sort of internal dynamics of that, but it's pretty disappointing to looking from the outside, because it looks like the internal aspects, the personalities and all that is taking place over is kind of ahead of politics, and that's, it should be the other way around, you know?
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's disappointing. As we said earlier, it's clear that Podemos has a potential vote in the Basque Country. You know, it won the general election here. It's quite incredible to think that it won in 2016 parliamentary election. It won 15%. 2020, it won 8%, and now it's down. You know, Podemos out of the parliament, so Samoa have won. I don't know where they go from here. Like in Galicia recently, the election was a bit of a disaster for Podemos and Samoa as well, isn't it?
So
I don't know how long this can go on for. I think they're both standing against each other in the European election in June, aren't they?
Yeah, that's going to be the big contest. It's sort of all or nothing for Podemos in that. They're putting Irene Montero, the former equality minister, as their head candidate. And so they're banking on a decent result there. I mean, again, within Sumar, pretty much universal frustration at the candidate that Yolanda Diaz has chosen. She's an interesting person, who would probably fit in the list somewhere, but not as a leading as the top of your list. The ex-head of the refugee NGO here in Spain, CEAR. So she has a good background on migrant rights, etc. So she'd be perfect in the European Parliament. But no public profile, a marginal figure who again fits that build of an independent professional profile, but has no political weight behind her. It's so, and I think Sumar find themselves in a very difficult position in the European elections, because there is a potential split, even further potential split. There's a vote in the next couple of days to see whether they're scared that Unida will go with them, because they're scared that Unida are furious that they've only been given, I think it's fourth on the list. And
there can't be another split, can
there? No, there could be. Honestly, I think Jesus. The only thing holding back another split is communist discipline at this point. But some of the messaging coming out from Scandinavia in the last few days, they are absolutely furious. And so there's that going on in the background. And the fact that basically Sumar are going to be squeezed between the Bildu Esquerra Republicana list on the one hand and the Podemos list on the other hand. Because Podemos, I mean, Irene Montero is a national figure. She's a polarizing figure, but she's a national figure. Sumar's candidate is an unknown political figure. I mean, I would say that their number two on the list is someone I really respect, Jaume Asens from Catalan Comunes. He's currently in Turkey. He will be traveling. If the Gaza flotilla goes ahead this week, he will be traveling to Gaza, which along with Ada Kalera, which is a pretty incredible gesture. And actually, I should say one of our friends on the podcast, Nadia Fernandez, she's been on a few times, and current MP in the Extremadura region. And I have to say, the Spanish left on Gaza in general obviously has been amazing. But yeah, in terms of the splits, yeah, the European elections are looking very difficult. And Sumar seemed capable of picking a fight with the socialists. I think that's also strategically chosen useful fight with the socialists. So
I mean, hopefully before the next general election, something can get sorted out and they can piece themselves back together again, because it's not going to work like this, like splitting and falling apart. Like there's no
exactly, yeah. And there's even without, I mean, you can no longer book. Podemos, even internally, there's no balance. And at the moment, the issue is, yeah, I mean, as you said, there's no real political differences. The issue is tactical stuff like messaging, slight differences around how to approach the coalition, plus personal differences. And that's really it. I mean, Podemos is a slightly sad side at this point in terms of, you know, it's had a huge exodus of personnel, etc. And it doesn't seem to have much more ambitions beyond sort of getting Irene Montero a seat. But like, I mean, Sumar should have offered Yone Balara a ministry before Christmas, tried to keep the thing together. Pablo Bustamdoy, who took over, is a very interesting figure, but has no political weight. He's an independent and has been completely absent from the media. Like he hasn't brought, you know, in terms of he hasn't brought anything substantive to the table as a ministry.
I think that the future of the coalition is to a large extent going to hang on how Junts per Catalunya to play it, you know, and that the election in Catalonia next month is going to have a big impact on that, but also just how they decide to approach it. Are they really going to? They claim that they're going to push for an independence referendum. I don't see how Pessoa are just never ever going to even broach that. So it's difficult to know what they can ask for after the amnesty law that's going to satisfy them. So there is the potential that, you know, you could think about it like the next general election is, 2027 would be the official timescale, but the next election could come around very, very quickly, depending on how politics develops, even over the next, you know, month or so.
I agree. Like, I think the Catalan elections are key, and I think in that scenario, Sanchez has a big dilemma. The socialists are going to win in Catalonia, or they'll be the largest party in Catalonia, and that after the Basque elections gives breathing space after, you know, 6 weeks of corruption scandals. But in terms of nationally, in terms of the stability of the coalition, a Puigdemont-led government would probably be the best case scenario. Because there is a theory, I've seen people mention it, that yeah, if Puigdemont doesn't, it looks like Junts, his party will come in second. But if he doesn't get it, you know, if he doesn't get in, he's obviously promised to leave frontline politics. But the question then is, do they bring then coalition with them? The whole thing has been framed, you know, I think Puigdemont as a communicator is a very interesting figure, and he's framing these elections as all or nothing. But what exactly does that nothing entail? Will he bring down, or will, you know, Junts will lose a lot of incentives if they're left in opposition with either Esquerra or socialists in some sort of governing arrangements? This was also one of the dilemmas of last year. You know, before anyone was talking about this, it was a dilemma like the socialists were talking about internally in terms of the Barcelona City Hall, was do they allow Junts in in the city hall there to give them more leverage at a national level. You know, sort of the complexities of multi-level Spanish politics are quite interesting in that sense.
Yeah, and I think you touched on it earlier that for these parties that have independence as their, you know, their stated goal, it's difficult not to support a PSOE government, because to do so would essentially be to say that you'd be allowing, you'd be accepting a PP Vox government to happen, or the potential for the Spanish electorate to vote for one. And, you know, there could be a backlash to that amongst the voters in Catalonia. But at the same time, it's not easy to support one either if there's no forward movement on your principal goal, and there's not been, you know. And the amnesty is a win for the independence parties, there's no doubt about that. But in terms of actually moving forward, in terms of achieving even more devolved powers at the Catalan level, which Esquerra Republicana has been demanding the same level of autonomy as the Basque autonomous community has, it doesn't seem like there's the basis for that to happen either. I published a book a couple of years ago called Scotland After Britain, and what me and my co-authors argued is that in Scotland, in Catalonia, there's the same problem of what the Catalans, actually, we've kind of taken the term from the Catalans, called neo-autonomism, where basically you have a kind of nationalist framing to your politics, but without any actual forward movement to achieve your goals. And over time, that can, a cynicism can grow, and an apathy can grow. And that's what's happened in Scotland. And I think that's what's happening in Catalonia as well. And that's partly why the independence parties are losing ground to the Catalan Socialist Party, the PSOE's party in Catalonia, because their core of support has been demoralised. They don't want to go out and campaign for them anymore. They don't believe that they're going to achieve what they say they're going to do. They think there's all promises and they never deliver. So it's they're caught in a bit of a bind. And I think if the election result is bad for Esquerra Republicana, especially for Junts per Catalunya, they're going to move towards the idea that this isn't working for us to support the Spanish government. We're not getting support from the Catalan people as a result of it. Anyway, we've moved a long way from talking about the Basque.
It is all related. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the one thing I do have sympathy for Samar is the fact that they're trying to organize themselves internally while having to fight very difficult. You know, in Spanish politics is just this endless sort of. When you have elections every 2 months, I mean, you know, you had local elections last May, local elections, general election July. I mean, they should have had a year's sort of rest before the urban elections to organize. Whereas in fact, they had to fight, you know, Galicia, Basque, now Catalan, which, you know, was a bit of a surprise as well before the European elections. So, I mean, it's just a sense of fatigue and exhaustion sets in. I mean, one last thing on the Catalan issue is, I quite liked, it was the analysis by Enric Juliana, La Vanguardia. It was sort of talking about, you mentioned what the PP offered the Basque Nationalist Party. They also, of course, approached Junts to potentially support their party or a FIFA-led government back in September. They seem to have offered the Basque Nationalist Party a ministry, potentially the Ministry of Industry. So, like putting, you know, giving them a pretty weighty economic ministry. What they offered Junts and Puigdemont indirectly was an effective amnesty, because what they said was the socialists can give you an amnesty law on paper, but they can't implement it. We control the courts. If you want a proper amnesty, we're the ones who can give it to you. We're the ones, you know, like because we control the Supreme Court or whatever. And so they said, look, we can't give you an actual amnesty law, but we can ensure nobody goes to jail. You know, you'll get a slap on the wrist when you come back, and then we'll pardon you, something like that. Now, obviously, that's, you know, this has all come out subsequently, but like that, you know, that is Spanish policy. You know, whatever Sanchez might be destroying Spain by engaging with these people, but like, you know, obviously, like, yeah, the PP are in there too.
Yeah, there's so much game playing going on, isn't there?
Yeah,
it's because of the It's because the politics is so fractured, and you have to rely on small parties to try to govern. I am pretty convinced that at some point there's going to be a big backlash, a sort of authoritarian backlash to all of this. Like, I think you look at the Spanish nationalists, like sort of far right mobilizations against amnesty law. They were pretty big. They lasted a long time. I think you're right that Vox and PP have a problem whereby it's difficult to win a majority in Spain without the sort of peripheral nations, Basque Country, Catalonia, Galicia. Well, Galicia, the PP are strong anyway, but Basque Country, without the Basque Country and Catalonia, it's quite difficult to find a route towards a majority. But I still think it's likely that's going to happen at some point. And when it does, there's going to be a big backlash to everything that's happened. You know, like the right are seething about, the amnesty law, are seething about the rise of Bildu in the Basque Country. So, at some point the things are going to turn, and the fragile kind of progressive government that's held together won't, and we'll see what they do. Like, different people have different views on this. Like, I'm of the view that politics in general in Europe is becoming more authoritarian, and at some point that's going to be reflected at the Spanish state level. They might even try to take powers away from the autonomous communities. I don't know exactly what it would look like, but I suspect that the kind of fragility of the politics of the last since 2020 is at some point it's going to come up against a sort of Spanish nationalist bulwark, and at that point we'll see how the independence parties respond, whether they feel like they have to approach it things differently, different strategies, different tactics to the kind of strategies they've had up until now. I don't know, but like, that's my sense of where, and maybe it's I'm overly pessimistic, but that's my sense of
No, I mean
where
that's
Spanish
no, like
politics is headed.
yeah. I mean, it's obviously the current governing arrangement in Madrid is very fragile as it is, as we said. You know, it's, I mean, yeah. Obviously, the other issue then is the dilemma for the PP. On the one hand, is yeah, how do you reach out to these peripheral areas while at the same time not leaving too much space for Vox on its right flank, and how could he, obviously, it was a big tent right-wing party before Vox, before Ciudadanos' rise, similar to the Republican Party or something in the US, having everybody from the extreme right to sort of centrist economic liberals in the same party. How do they reform that majority? Obviously, if we're talking about a Vox coalition, see what's happening at a regional level in places like Valencia, where they repealed the historical memory law last week, and basically the word dictatorship is no longer valid to use the word dictatorship for to describe the Franco regime in parts of Spain. So I mean, what we're seeing isn't so much, what we're seeing isn't so much just a repeal of what would, sort of certain gains. It's a regression on in areas such as that, beyond where you would have had the consensus. No, before, but beyond where the consensus was 20 years ago or whatever, when historical memory movements emerged first. So yeah, I mean that is the issue. I mean, Spain, you're right, like Spain has been an exception in Europe up until now, but how long can it hold out, and on what basis is the current governing arrangement? I mean, the left will lose power at some point, probably in the next elections, or the ones after. Yeah, what comes after that is not clear, I suppose.
And the national fissures of Spanish politics
Yes.
are, they're always going to be relevant. It's just the
Yeah.
nature of Spain as a country that these national divisions are particularly pronounced. They're always going to be a key aspect to Spanish politics. You can't understand Vox. Vox is very similar to other far right parties in Europe in one sense, but in another sense, it's not, because the reason for Vox's rise was all about the Catalan referendum. It's
Exactly.
pretty simple,
Yeah.
you
The internal,
know.
yeah, the internal enemy. I mean, that's the thing, is obviously populism is based on building a sort of chain of equivalence, but yeah, the master signifier, if you use the term, for the far right in Spain, is the internal Catalan Basque enemy. And then beyond that, the communists, and beyond that, the feminists. And then, you know, in a sense, migration and migrants are very much further down the chain of that type of chain compared to, you know, obviously in Italy and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, look, Ben, this has been a great, really great discussion. We sort of, I liked how we sort of, you know, sort of went quite off, but like, you know, taking in the bigger picture. But yeah, it's been great talking to you, getting your views. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, man.